Good evening, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona. And thanks for tuning in to another of our virtual events. And tonight we have Julia Bryan Thomas. She's going to be discussing the new book, The Radcliffe Ladies Reading Club. And our good friend Lauren Willig has joined us to as a special guest host this evening. And her latest book is Two Wars and a Wedding. And we do still have some autographed copies. I will put links to both of these books in the comments field. So, and also if you have questions, go ahead and put them in, and Barbara will bring me back online, on screen rather, towards the end of the hour, and I would be happy to ask any questions. So Barbara, over to you.
Thank you very much, Patrick. Well, I want to thank Lauren and Julia for agreeing to do this. And in some senses, they're going to raise the veil for me, because as we were discussing before this started, when I chose colleges, I was actually accepted at Smith and Radford, not Radcliffe, but I chose to go because they were women's colleges. And I thought that Stanford 1958 offered a wider, I don't know what I thought. Maybe it's just guys. No, it was going to California. most of my high school class, in fact, did go to Eastern colleges. And it's hard for anyone today to recognize, you know, just how cloistered women's college life, I think, was, or at least it appeared to be when you were making those decisions. And then there were kind of pairs, which maybe Lauren and Julia could talk about. Radcliffe, Harvard's kind of obvious, but you know, where did Wellesley and, you know, how did Brown and Dartmouth and all these other schools, how did they pair up? Whereas at Stanford, we were all on the same campus, so it really wasn't all that difficult. We're also in two different wartime periods, and so we are talking about women, or post-war periods anyway, who are making choices in a world that's changing and trying to direct their lives in ways that maybe they didn't start out when they went to college to figure out. So Smith versus Radcliffe, educate me, ladies.
Oh my goodness, where should we even begin? I was really fascinated by how different the cultures of the two colleges are. And as I was reading Radcliffe Ladies Reading Club, I was curious about how you went about trying to recreate the experience of a Radcliffe undergrad in the 1950s. Were you able to find letters, journals, memoirs? What sources did you use?
Oh, that's a good question. I did some research, actually, just first talking to some women in an older generation who were the first in their families to go to college. And so I talked to some people, you know, in my area. I live here in Oklahoma, and they've come from different parts of the country. But I also did a lot of research about the actual campus. And one of my favorite resources that I found was the newsletters written by the girls who were students at Radcliffe in the 1950s. So they had their own little newsletters. And I even quoted from it in the book at one point, and it just told so much about where their focus was, you know, their goals, their plans, how for some of them it was more like a finishing school than really going to college. It was just a place for a nice girl to go while she waited to hopefully find a husband on the campus of Harvard. So that was really interesting. And some very nice people at Harvard also worked with me about detail about the college and everything that I needed to go in the book.
Was it hard? I mean, because this is always the annoying thing with writing historical fiction in places people are still living in. Buildings have changed. When I was a grad student at Harvard, I used to walk over to the Radcliffe Institute because there was a bench a friend of mine really liked over there. But of course, it had all changed so much. Radcliffe dorms had turned into Harvard houses. Was it hard unpicking those threads and trying to dig out the campus these women would have experienced from the lived-in campus today?
You know, I just watched a lot of movies from the time period. And what I think that bench that you mentioned, I actually put in the book because it's a famous bench. And I did research on that too. It was so interesting to go back in time and look at some of the at the way that women were allowed into college at that time. For example, during World War II, women were going only to Radcliffe, men were going to Harvard. But after the war, when all of the young men went off to fight for fight the Nazis in Europe, women were allowed into the college because they had to keep the college running. And so they were in a time of change. And I love doing research about that. I read several books that talked about that experience. So I felt like I really was listening to women from that era.
What was the sense you got of their academic lives? You know, were they mostly humanities focused? Did they have science interests? Where was it more of a finishing school focus, or did you get a sense of really vibrant intellectual worlds?
I think there was a mix. There truly was. There were serious women who were there to go to college. There were women who wanted to get into college, but also had their eye on the prize of marriage and that sort of thing. And I would say, yes, more at that time, more humanities based. Of course, you were seeing women starting to get interested in law and medicine and all sorts of things like that. But it's still early days and few women in those disciplines in the 40s and 50s.
You know, it's so funny because I've always felt strongly history is not linear. It's, if anything, it's a spiral. And the sense I've had, especially researching my two Smith books, one set in the 1890s and one set in the 19-teens, is that those two generations of women's college grads were much more academically driven than their counterparts in the post-World War II period. That was a generation that was trying to prove, those were generations that were trying to prove to the boys that they were just as serious, as opposed to the World War II pushback and the return of femininity. You know, in Two Wars and a Wedding, there's a real woman, a Radcliffe doctor, who's running the Red Cross in Greece. And I find it so fascinating that by the time your women are on campus, it's actually, the tide has turned in the other direction.
It's true. And if you think about the era, how they were, you know, the image of the 1950s housewife with pearls and heels with her apron when she's cooking dinner and that sort of thing. And women's opinions, you know, it was the right before the big push for women's rights and equality and all of those things. And so things were bubbling up to the surface. So I think that in my story, I really tried to show some women had one mindset and some had a different mindset, because that was all represented over the course of the novel and in that time period too.
Let me just say, as the person who actually was a woman, these choices, that you've hit upon, I was being funny about why I went to Stanford, but in truth, the image that I had was finishing school. You know, I came from grew up in a very wealthy suburb north of Chicago. And so 98% of my high school graduating class went to college, which would be really unusual. And many of them were going to be able to afford, because it was expensive to go to Ivy League schools. You know, they were going to be able to afford that. But there was the whole kind of, finishing school, housewife, and I'm poor women who were genuinely driven. But I think for an awful lot of my friends anyway, it was just sort of a stage, you know, to go. And a lot of attention was paid to, what boys' colleges were adjacent, or what kind of mix you would have. I know there were some really, you know, scary things where there'd be mixers, right? And women would be invited from one college and sort of paraded, or, you know, before the men. And so you hoped, because it was not easy for women to go out on their own, you hoped that you would bond with somebody fairly quickly to die, because otherwise your social life was going to be largely limited to, as it is in your book, other women. And, you know, maybe you'd never even get to leave college. And there was some of that at Stanford. We had a dress code. It's hard for people to believe that. Mrs. Stanford's dress code was in effect. We could not wear pants. We had to get up every day. We couldn't walk on campus if we didn't weren't wearing. So we used to wear slips and raincoats because that was the fastest way to get dressed. We had a curfew of 10 o'clock. There was no liquor allowed in the women's dormitories. I mean, there was a very kind of Victorian overlay, but outside of the dorms, it was a very different kind of a vibe and a big interest in science and other things. So I think that there was a more career-driven atmosphere for women there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's been a long time. You know, it's been 70 years since, not quite, 65 anyway.
Well, I mean, and it's interesting how the wheel keeps turning because you definitely, I think in the earlier periods, for the women who are first fighting to prove that they have the right to go to college and that they can have a college experience like a man, they're very career driven. And it's a very conscious choice to go to college. It's not taken for granted. If you are a young woman in the 1890s or even the 19 teens and you're making a choice to go to college, it's saying something about you because you could just easily have done your debutante year.
Exactly.
But by the time you get another generation on and we're at Radcliffe in 1955, I think it's so interesting how college has become much more of a commonplace. And because of that, you see the career drive go down.
I agree. I think that's so true. And I think one of the issues that I address in my book is that some of the women who are there don't necessarily appreciate it until they don't have that experience anymore. And they realize what they had and what they kind of let go of too easily.
Well, you have four different Radcliffe student viewpoint characters in this book. One a socialite from Newport, one a farm girl from upstate New York, one an artist from San Francisco, and one a scholarship girl from Akron, Ohio. How did you come up with these four different characters? Did they come to you? Did you plot them out deliberately? How did it all come about?
Well, a couple of them came to me very quickly. For example, Tess, who is the student from Akron, Ohio, the student, that's very much the way that I approached college when I was a young person. I'm that sort of a serious kind of individual, not that that's, you know, completely how my personality is, but, and Caroline came to me, but when I originally was working on it, I thought, well, the book club can't have only four people. I need to have 10. I was trying to manage 10 girls. And then I realized what an unwieldy concept that was. So I had to pare it back to something manageable and something that I felt would really work. So I came up with the four that I thought were the most diverse, the most interesting. And you know how it is when you go to college, everyone's completely different. And they're from all sorts of places that you've never been before. And so I just thought that was interesting to bring together a diverse group of women like that.
You know, I was curious about that. What was the regional breakdown at Radcliffe at the time? Was it drawing primarily from New England or was it pulling more broadly from elsewhere?
Well, I would say New England primarily, but there were people who always wanted to be able to go to one of the Seven Sisters and to be part of an Ivy League education. So you would see people coming out of places like San Francisco, for example, and people who'd heard of it, people who'd seen it mentioned and applied to different colleges. So, but I do think that New England was the primary demographic for that time period.
So of course, there's also the
Midwestern one, though.
What were you saying, Barbara?
Fairly hefty Midwestern pool. I think probably far fewer from the West Coast. Because travel was harder in those days too. Don't forget,
right.
You know, that it was a long slog from, you know, Cambridge to San Francisco. But there were a lot of Midwestern people that went east.
Mm-hmm. That was something I noticed even with my 19-teen Smithies, was a number from Cleveland and a handful from California. It's fascinating to me how even in those days of relatively slow train travel, people made the haul. Mm-hmm. East for those colleges.
Those are pretty great colleges. to make the trip for. How did you choose the colleges that you wrote about?
Oh, I stumbled onto a true story of a group of Smithies who went off to France during World War I. And so I was working directly from the letters and diaries of the real women. So I was immediately grounded in their context because it was a real group of women doing real things. And I just changed the names and played with their emotional lives. So it was a different generative experience rather than how did you come to the idea of writing this book? Did the women's college come first or did the reading club come first?
Well, okay, that's a wonderful question. The college, I think, came first. And it all came about because in the summer of 2018, I was accepted to the Yale Writers Workshop. And it was such a phenomenal experience, especially to go as an older student and get to live on the campus. I know you're a Yalie as well.
And yes, where did they put you on campus?
Oh my goodness, now I can't remember the name of the dorm. It's going to fly right out of my head. We were in one of the newer dorms, I think. It was beautiful. It was wonderful night. We actually lived on campus in the dorm rooms students. And when we left after our time there, our writing coach said, I want each of you to write a 1,000-word short story once a month and submit them to each other. And then I want you to vote on which one is the best one. Of course, I'm really competitive. And I thought this is a great opportunity for me. As everyone else groaned, the students like Tess, I decided this is a wonderful experience. I'd already published 2 novels, but I just wanted to beef up my own experience and my own knowledge about writing and to find my strengths and weaknesses, which I think really did occur during a workshop. So anyway, as I was living there and I came home to write those essays, one of the essays I wrote was a germ of a story, and it was about the children who evacuated from Guernsey during World War II. On June 5th, in 1940, 5,000 children were evacuated in a single day without their parents. The parents only had 24 hours to make the decision to send them or to keep them on the island, and they were gone for 5 years. So I wrote that story, and it was just a short story submitted to my group of 10, and it won that month. But when I was finished, I thought, you know, that's what I want to do. I want to write that as a book. And then my very next idea was I want to express how I felt being back on the college at Yale and on campus and how that felt for me now. I was just so seized with the joy of having that opportunity again. So that's where I started. And I'd always wanted to write a book about a bookshop as well. So that's how I married the world of Alice and the bookshop with the girls at the college.
And so, I mean, throughout, of course, the girls are learning and growing through reading these different texts selected by Alice, the bookshop owner. Did you go into it with an idea of which books you wanted them to read? Or did that develop as their characters developed?
I had a very long list. I just started jotting down my favorite books, books that I thought had important messages for women, both then that would have been interesting for women in 1955, but also now for women and the things that they're going through in 2023. So I made a list, probably 15 or 20 books, and then I pared them down as I went and just had to get tough with myself and say, what are my favorites? I could have done many more chapters about the books, but we couldn't let that take over the whole story. So I knew I was going to start with Jane Eyre, which I did. And then it just kind of came together a little organically about that. But I used favorite books with favorite quotes and just things that I believe really had a message, a positive message for women.
Were there any you had to leave out that you particularly regretted?
Well, there were a couple I left on the cutting room floor, we should say. One of them, I really love We the Living by Ayn Rand. And I thought that was fabulous. And just if you're thinking about feminism, you're thinking about women's rights and how women have been oppressed and overcome different circumstances. That was one book that I really did enjoy that I wish I wanted to put in, but I just didn't have room. I also was going to add Bonjour Tristesse, but that the subject didn't flow. So I just decided that's not going to work. And we stuck with some of the others that I think possibly the surprise one for me was Anne Morrow Lindbergh's Gift from the Sea. Mm-hmm. And that happens to be one of my favorite books. I read it about once a year. And I really enjoyed her story and being able to talk about some of the interesting remarks she made about women and marriage and finding yourself. So I very much enjoyed working with that aspect of the book.
And I really like the way you wove in how complicated it was in the aftermath of World War II, given her husband's sentiments, you know, and how the girls struggle to divorce her reality from her words and her message.
I think that she was a very interesting character because she did things that I didn't agree with in my own personal life. And yet I still found that some of her wisdom about life and marriage and relationships and your relationship with yourself were very moving to me. And so when I had done more research about her, I had been reading the book for a few years before I discovered some of that. And at first it put me off a little bit. And then I thought she grew as a woman too, and she changed. And that's another lesson for us too, because just because someone has certain values at one stage of their life doesn't mean that they can't grow and change over time.
Right. I think such an important lesson for anyone writing or reading historical fiction that nothing is static and everything is about change over time. Yes. So speaking of change, I was really interested reading this book because, of course, it opens with Alice, who's fleeing an unhappy marriage to start a new life as a bookshop owner in Cambridge. And then we meet Tess, the scholarship student from Ohio. And yet the focus of the book really eventually settles on Caroline, the socialite from Newport. And I was curious, going into it, had you initially thought one of the others was going to be the focus of the book? Did this change for you, or was this, or did you always know that this was really going to be Caroline's story?
Well, I always knew the basic outline of the story before I went in. I knew that I was going to be dealing with Caroline, and I knew that I just had a real heart for her. And I thought I could see the good in her that maybe somebody couldn't see just looking at her from the surface. And when I wrote my synopsis and sent it to my agent, she said, "Oh my, you've changed." She said, "Look what you're doing here. You know, you're starting with one character and you're telling us we're going to care about someone else by the end. That's going to be a challenge," she said, "but I think you can do it." But that's just what felt right when I was writing it. So I didn't know how much I would love Caroline and how much I would enjoy writing her story. And I actually had without giving any spoilers, I had actually a more severe ending, not for her, but for the other character involved in her big story. And then I walked it back and thought, redemption for everyone. Yeah, and hope,
and so young, learning. Yeah, that love for her really comes across. And I love the way you invert the Grace Kelly narrative.
I'm such a Grace Kelly fan, and I love movies. I could just watch 50s movies exclusively, probably. And Grace Kelly was just magical, and I could just see her so much as a young person who perhaps didn't have the best family. And so she was really kind of in my mind when I wrote that, of course.
So was it ever hard keeping, you've got five distinct female viewpoint characters. Did you ever have trouble juggling them all, staying in voice for them?
I think Evie was a little bit more difficult than some of the others, and she didn't have as strong a voice. She and Tess sort of sounded a little similar to me at the beginning, and I had to work on that a little bit. Of course, Caroline took over. I just had no idea what she was going to be from the very beginning. And she's just so, I thought, kind of a difficult character in some ways because she just wasn't playing by the rules. But of course, you know, she was just her own self. And Merritt, I wanted Merritt to be strong in her own way, and yet not the kind of person who seeks the limelight. So that was interesting to kind of draw balance with her. They were a fun group to write.
Hard balancing that many backstories.
Mm-hmm. Well, imagine if I'd written 10. Oh my goodness. Every time I think about that, I found my notes the other day and it was, you know, all the women and all their names. And I thought, oh my goodness, when that's like an actual roster.
When you were planning to do that, were you actually going to be in all of their heads, or were some of them just going to be named side characters?
They weren't going to be in all their heads, no. But even just trying to juggle too many people just made it unwieldy. Mm-hmm. So I pared back. There are mentions of people here and there, but I just needed it to be a little more manageable.
Well, it's so funny because now that I know you spent time at Yale, I can understand the anti-Harvard bias of this book.
Oh, no.
Reading it, I thought, okay, you know, as a Yalie, I'm always happy bashing Harvard. But wow, there are some really unpleasant Harvard guys in this narrative. And I was wondering, where did that come from? Was that something that you heard in the interviews you conducted?
No, I think that I drew more from real life, or people I'd known, or people, or, you know, or just had known of, and that sort of thing, and situations that I had done research about. So I don't think that they were necessarily representative of Harvard as much as they were just maybe
men of representative their time.
Certain men of their time. Exactly right. So I actually think Harvard's such a beautiful campus and a beautiful place. But I did think there was a little bit of male arrogance going on. And I think I had one of my characters say in the middle of the book, we're not man haters, are we? And I really wanted to make that point. No, we really aren't. There are the Rosanna Brotzis out there, as you know. But, you know, one also doesn't have to, you know, go along with everything that we hear and see when we're that impressionable age.
Yes. So I was curious, because the reading group is such a large part of this book, do you have a book club?
I did have a book club for about 10 years. And we had, I think 11 or 12 at one point. But eventually over time, people moved, you know, views changed. You know, some people dropped out. And it just really, I was teaching at the same time that I was writing, and it just became a little bit much for me. I think I was in it for 11 years. And then even though I had started it and I hated to leave my group, it just working and writing and being involved with my husband's books, he's a writer, he's written 14 historical novels. And so just working as an assistant to him, it was just a lot. And so that was one thing that has been sacrificed along the way. Although I do hope to be in a book club again someday.
Maybe one, even one that reads some of the same books as the Women of the Radcliffe Ladies Reading Club.
I'm going to say that when I picked this book up and started it, I thought that this book was actually really going to be about Alice and Alice's story. And you know, that her life would be changed by the Radcliffe that came to read the books, or validated, or whatever you want to call it. And then it turns out that she's really, it's the other way around, that she's really the facilitator or the agency, so to speak, where these young women, I thought that was interesting. I mean, I don't think it was misdirection, but I really did enter the book thinking it was the Alice's story.
Yeah, it's always so interesting when you think of the different books a book could be when you go into them. Mm-hmm. And I felt this book, there were three separate potential books going into it. There was the Alice story, there was the Tess story, and then the big twist was we get Caroline's story.
Right. Mm-hmm. Caroline's was the one I least expected.
Same here.
I think back to, it was difficult to really focus on the educate for me anyway, I didn't get as much out of my Stanford years as I should have. I was too far away from home and too young, and I was distracted by kind of learning about life, you know, part of going to college, really, you know, should be doing that. And I've often thought, you know, looking back, I could have done more with it. I subsequently went on to graduate school, made up for it. But and so I wonder, you know, two of your characters, no spoilers here, have to make decisions about, you know, what their college is going, you know, what it means for them, that opportunity for education, or should life provide them with a different education? And I'm wondering, you know, I'm wondering if that wasn't a fairly common thing in a time when why you went to college was not all that clear, is what Lauren was talking about. You know, for your women, Lauren, in the earlier time, that dedication, they didn't miss their opportunity, or, you know, dilute their opportunities, so to speak. I think about Dorothy Sayers going to Oxford, you know, whatever, I can't remember which college it was.
One of the most perfect books of all time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I meant when she was admitted to whichever college it was at Somerville, I think it was, they weren't allowed to matriculate, you know, they could go to college. Mm-hmm. She was able, but they weren't allowed a degree from Oxford. Yeah. And yet, you know, there was so much dedication there on her part. You know, we're only a century away from that. I mean, in terms
yes.
of time, it has not been that long, but wow, the whole culture has. I remember, Lauren, I mean, you know, you went to law school, I read the law, and I will never forget, because the closest law library to me at that time in my life was the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. So I would drive up there, you know, and I'll never forget the first time I went in and I settled in the library in Mike Carroll and had my coffee. And then, as coffee does, it was time, you know, to find the facilities. And when I went into the women's room, I looked around and I started laughing, because what they'd done is they had ripped the urinals out of the wall. They didn't build it for women.
Mm-hmm. I mean, like you say, not that long ago, when I went to my Yale interview, my interviewer sat me down and said, well, I'm not sure how much use I'm going to be to you, because when I went to Yale, there were no women. So I can't really answer any of your questions. And I told him, well, I don't think that should affect your telling me about the academic experience. You know, a woman has a mind too. But it was very funny that his automatic response was, well, my campus was all men, you're a girl, not sure I can help you here.
Absolutely. Barbara, I think a lot of people had the same feeling you did. And one of my favorite books growing up in high school was a Betty Smith book, and everybody knows A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, right?
Oh, but she wrote
Joy in the Morning. Oh, I can't believe you even know about it.
Of course.
No one knows about that.
But I'll never forget her holding his pens like Dora for David.
I know. I just love that book. And just, she wanted to go to college so much. She wanted the opportunity to get an education. And so that's always been in the back of my mind, and how she was not a real student. But then when she was allowed to go in and sit in the classroom, she was married to a law student. So, you know, experiences like that just really matter to me. Some people really, really wanted to go to college, and other people had the opportunity and perhaps did not make as much of it as they could have. So I kind of wanted to represent all of those feelings.
There's a great line in Gaudy Night, which, you know, Barbara was just talking about Dorothy Sayers, where there is one student who's making a fool of herself over boys, and the other characters very angrily say they shouldn't admit women like that because they're keeping the real ones out. But that said, in the 1930s, I think it's that pre-war generation. Mm-hmm. That still, that was the generation where women were first being admitted. Well, that's of course England, but so women were first being admitted as barristers. Women were fighting their way into all the fields. And then you get the sea change where.
Absolutely.
You know, part of the sea change, ladies, comes from the fact that if you got the education, what then were you going to do with it? Because, you know, we're not particularly focused on careers. I was always curious of my fellow students who actually wanted to be doctors or lawyers or something. You know, there wasn't just some sort of amorphous, you know, I'll get my degree and then what will I do with it? And, you know, I thought about law school, Lauren, and I can still remember the guidance counselor is saying to me, you don't want to go to law school because then you'll just be stuck doing, you know, domestic and children's law. He couldn't envision, you know, anything at that time. And yet Sandra Day O'Connor was there not that far before me. And she didn't see a path. But it was harder to see a path to what you were going to do with your education when women were not so absorbed into professions and so forth.
And you're fighting, you know, society's expectations and sometimes even your own parents' expectations. I know a lot of people of my generation, their parents said it's secretarial school or perhaps become a teacher. Other than that, you need to look for a husband. So I know a lot of people who dealt with that in their lives too.
Well, it certainly comes across in the book. I think it's very telling that of your most driven student, Tess, her dream is to work at a magazine because that is a job for a woman that is within reach for her.
Exactly. I loved her ambitions and her storyline, but she was going to have to start back at ground zero and, you know, rethink how she was going to get there. So that was fun to write. Tess was, and you're right. It was what a woman could reach for.
Right. I mean, I think it's fascinating thinking of what constitutes ambition for women in different periods. I mean, you know, Barbara knows with two wars and a wedding, I have a heroine who wants to be an archaeologist. And at that time, that's pushing the outer bounds. And it's just sort of barely within reach. And then in the 1950s, you have, you know, the magazine career. That's something that you can grasp.
You know, that's, I think, why I started with Jane Eyre, because I really wanted to show, even though you're talking about a governess and a wealthy landowner, what you're really talking about is people who consider themselves equals. And I wanted to start there. You know, women are equals of men and they need to be thought of like that. And it gave the girls a starting place to talk about how can I be the equal of men? And that's a conversation that goes on throughout the book.
Well, it also gives such an interesting window in their character, into their characters, how they react to the question of Rochester versus St. John.
Yes, that's right. You know, I just thought that, you know, sorry. I just really agreed with that St. John was, I mean, just in the book, what an unusual character and how he was so unsuitable and how that's not how women should pick husbands, of course.
But it's the old Charlotte Lucas problem.
Oh, it is, isn't it? It's true. That's true.
So, Barbara, do we have any questions from our studio audience?
We can certainly bring Patrick up in. Indeed, that's it. But before we quit, I wanted to ask you, neither one of you actually went to Radcliffe, am I right?
That's so right.
You can't actually tell me what the difference between Smith and Radcliffe as two cultures would be. Because I have to believe that there were similarities, but I would think that each of those seven sisters had a different culture, a different vibe, and you know, they were not homogenous. And so
and they felt those differences keenly. I mean, you know, I went to an all-girls school in New York, and I can cite you chapter and verse on the minute difference between all the five New York all-girls schools and why these matter. And I think it's the same with the women's colleges. You know, Smith felt strongly that they were the academics, you know, cloistered in Northampton. And whereas I think, you know, the sense I get is that Radcliffe, I mean, their classes are taught by Harvard professors. And so they feel like they are really there with the boys. And sorry, side note, but you know, our conversation of Gaudy Night, it really fascinated me reading this, thinking about how differently Radcliffe could have gone, because there was that period where they were petitioning to be allowed Harvard degrees. I don't remember exactly when. I think it may have been the 1890s. And they could have gone the same path as the Oxford colleges, where eventually those women's colleges became part of the university and were granted Oxford degrees. But instead, the university shunted them off. And gave them their own separate degree system, even while giving them access to the university. I think that really, of course, you know more about this than I do, but that really shapes the character of an institution.
It does. It truly does. And it, I'm so sorry. I'm having some sore throat tonight. Yes, no, that's okay. And we're having a thunderstorm here, which is really distracting. But yes, I agree with you. And Radcliffe College, you know, they didn't even want to build Radcliffe in the first place because they didn't want to lose control. They didn't want women to be educated. So many people didn't. And so it was just a struggle to get it built in the first place. And then, of course, there was a struggle to get them into Harvard during the war, too. So quite interesting.
I mean, it's fascinating with all the women's colleges, their different origin stories, and each of them mm-hmm. has sort of their own charismatic founder, who's the person who then sets the tone for the university going forward, or sorry, the college going forward.
That's so true.
I mean, I always wondered, you know, if I were to, what would I have done? Would I have gone to Radcliffe? Would I have gone to Wellesley, which we have been brought up, you know, would I have gone to Smith? What are the other four?
Bryn Mawr, Mount Holyoke, Smith, Vassar, mm-hmm. Wellesley, Radcliffe. Who am I missing? I'm missing one. Barnard.
Okay. And Barnard's actually in New York, right? In the city.
Yes, and they're affiliated with Columbia, really, you know, much the same way Radcliffe was with Harvard.
Yeah. I remember Amanda Cross's book. Do you ever read Amanda Cross's
book? Oh my gosh, ages ago. I need to reread those.
Yeah, Carolyn Halperin. And, you know, so I mean, what was Wellesley associated with, if it was?
Wellesley was more closely associated with Harvard than with any of the other male universities. So Vassar and Smith both hung out with the Yale guys, and Wellesley and Radcliffe hung out with the Harvard guys.
Okay. So that creates differences too, you know, the relationship mm-hmm. you have with the men's college and the men's culture would also then help shape, you know, the, I just find it fascinating. You know, I completely missed it. So it's a, you know, one of those things where I feel like I'm on the outside looking in and wondering, mm-hmm. you know, it's like the road less traveled, I guess. You know.
Well, it's fascinating watching the internecine quarrels. When I was researching Band of Sisters, my World War I book, you get the Smithies who found the Smith College Relief Unit. And then at the end of the war, Vassar and Wellesley both found their own relief units and come in later to do reconstruction work. And all of them then mock Radcliffe for not having a relief unit. And they sort of the attitude you get in their letters is basically, well, isn't that just like Radcliffe? And so, I mean, of course, as you know, with these, you know, interscholastic rivalries, all of these things make sense to them at the time, these perceptions of characters. It's the same way Yaleys mock Harvard and Princeton people.
You know, but isn't that interesting when you think about Oxford and Cambridge as the rivalry between the two universities, but then within each university, there are the colleges. And, you know, so, but I mean, they're a little more proximate to each other in Oxford and in Cambridge than maybe scattered a little farther in New England, but nonetheless, maybe it was always, you know, I remember reading an absolutely fabulous mystery set in 13, maybe 50, a series. And one of the things that went on was because the Black Death had decimated the student population, it's what you're talking about, they would actually go and kidnap students from each other because they had to try to keep the college alive, you know.
Oh my gosh, that's fascinating.
Talk about history repeating itself. So there was this sort of poaching of students so that the institution wouldn't die while basically everybody did die because, you know, the death rate was so huge. So, you know, it's the same thing you were earlier talking about. The academic institutions, I think, have all always, you know, had to worry about, you know, funding and about who they were attracting. When I did my summer at Oxford, I went to Worcester College, and my tutor, Mr. Pitt, lived in the abbot's 12th century quarters at the end of the college. And, you know, I thought Harvard is old, but not that old.
It is so relatively new compared to
And, you know, but the dynamics were, are within colleges, I think, have always been largely the same, even you know, a millennium apart, not that different in many respects.
Well, I think Lauren, that's what makes them so fascinating, is you get these enclosed communities and incredibly intense rivalries and passions build within those enclosed communities.
And speaking of which, in your book, Lauren, I really enjoyed the Yale Easter eggs, like Maury's Association and things like that. That was really fun.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you appreciate them.
Lauren's book is really wonderful. And she takes you to wars you probably don't know much about. One of his in Greece, a war of independence, wasn't it?
It was the Greco-Turkish War, but it basically boiled down to a great war of independence.
In the late 19th century. And then the other is the the Spanish-American War.
Which we all remember with Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's you know, yellow journalism and, you know, remember the Maine and, you know, all sorts of things. But there were smaller conflicts that probably don't have as much attention paid to them today, is because they're overshadowed by the two big wars. And you know, I thought it was fascinating to see these smaller conflicts, smaller geographically, but yet they pulled in so many people, like your Smith woman.
It's fascinating to me how the world of the past just sometimes feels like a very, very small place where you keep bumping into the same historical characters over and over. Like Stephen Crane, the man who wrote The Red Badge of Courage, the book we all suffered through in school, he was a correspondent in the Greco-Turkish War, covering it for the, you know, American papers. And then he wound up hanging out with Teddy Roosevelt in Cuba during the Spanish-American War. And so you keep bumping up against the same people over and over.
How did you come up with the idea for two timelines like that? That was so fascinating.
Well, that's so sweet of you. That was I followed another real Smithy, a woman named Harriet Boyd Hawes, who had become an accidental war nurse in the Greco-Turkish War and went from there to the Spanish-American War. So I was really just following the path she set out for me. Although I do love the idea of trying to find obscure wars just for fun.
Well, Patrick, come and join us and see if we have any questions from the audience in a discussion that's just gone everywhere. So
that's the joy of poison pen discussions, is we never wind up talking about the things we thought we were going to talk about.
Digression is the entire juice.
Yeah, I feel way out of my league here. I went to a ASU state school.
Actually, you shouldn't, because the largest university now in the country, and it has developed so many different departments. I mean, today, I thought the medical school in downtown Phoenix was ASU. Only today did I come to realize it's really the University of Arizona. And now ASU is going to build its own rival medical school in downtown Phoenix. And I'm going to go right back to the Oxford-Cambridge Black Death.
That's what I was thinking. There's a story for you. Can't you just see a mystery novel set around a rivalry between the two institutions?
Right. Anyway, ASU is a remarkable school, Patrick. And, you know, turning into Oxford all by itself with multiple colleges and, you know, kind of one geographic. That's really true. That is.
And with much better weather.
That's true.
Right. I actually was invited to teach a class last fall for the Barrett, the Barrett College of, anyway, it's a very fancy kind of a think tank, sort of Yale within ASU. And I said to them that the only thing that I was competent to discuss with these earnest students, what was it I said? Aging gracefully and how to manage a small business. And afterward, they said to me that it was the most, the students were the liveliest they'd ever seen them. The dean said that to me, because those are sort of life skills that you're not taught in, you know, in a university setting. And, you know, they were asking me all kinds of interesting questions that apparently were not, you know, they were not really academic questions. They were more related to practicalities. So who knows? I may not be teaching it regularly.
I feel like aging gracefully, particularly as a woman, is a course that you need to teach on a larger scale.
Yeah, they were really interested in the practicalities of setting up a small business. and the things that can go wrong. The stuff that, you know, if you're a law student, you kind of learn, like, don't sign personal guarantees, you know, and finances and stuff like that. But people don't teach you things like that, you know, and many people learn them the hard way, a really brutal way.
Of course, Julie, you deal with this in your book with Alice, who starts her store.
Oh, yes, that's right. And, you know, that was kind of a risky move, I thought, especially for someone who didn't have very much security, but she was following her dreams. And there are so many people who have done that, especially in the book business. And I was fascinated with that type of story.
I have to admit, I kept picturing the Harvard bookstore building, because that's what it looked like in my head. Not the coop, but, you know, the independent one.
There's a bookstore in New York City called Three Lives Bookstore that is the actual picture for the Cambridge bookstore. And I had pinned it on Pinterest, and it's so pretty. And, I just save pictures of bookshops, and it has that exact, the red door and the black awnings and everything. It's just very beautiful. And so it's still open today. And it's one of my favorite little bookshops in New York. So that was my inspiration piece for that.
Where is it in New York?
Oh, goodness. It's been a few years since I've been to that particular bookstore. I'll have to look that up. I'm sorry. I can't remember off the top of my head. But it's called Three Lives.
Three Lives.
So were there any actual questions, Patrick, or do we just keep rolling over them?
I think.
Oops, sorry, Patrick.
I think you've answered them all.
As we just kept going.
Yeah, no, so, I don't see anything that you haven't actually covered.
Well, we didn't actually cover what they're writing next. So
I was just about to ask Julie that.
There we go. Let's do that. Each author, what are you working on now?
Okay, I'm working on a spy novel set in 1960 in Paris. And I can't tell you too much about it. It's scheduled to come out in March, I think, March or April of 2025. So I'm kind of combining some of my favorite things into something kind of juicy and intriguing, I hope. What about you, Lauren?
You're kind of fading away there, Julie.
Oh, you couldn't hear him. I said 1960 Paris spy intrigue novel.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if some of my storm is getting your Wi-Fi.
Oh, I know. And it's been distracting because I've had all this lightning right in my sight line there. Sorry about that.
No,
what are you working on?
Lauren, what are you working on?
Sure. Well, I've gone in the other direction. I'm back in 1800 right now with Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr as they investigate America's first fully recorded murder trial. So this is the first book I have ever written where it's all entirely real people doing what they actually did. And I have to tell you, writing in Hamilton's viewpoint is terrifying. Everyone thinks they own him. Writing Burr's viewpoint is surprisingly fun, but it's really about this murdered woman, Elma Sands, who's found strangled in a well in what was then Lispinard's Meadow and is now beneath a shop. And a young man at her cousin's boarding house is accused of murdering her, and his influential contractor brother hires Hamilton and Burr for the defense. So that's why I'm working. That's going to come out in January 2025.
That's wonderful. That's so
they
fun.
They both sound terrific. I'm going to give a shout out to Julia's husband, Will, who writes one of my all-time favorite historical novel series. It's late Victorian, and it's modeled a bit on Holmes and Watson. Llewellyn and Barker, and we have a guy who spent a lot of time in the Far East. That's the Sherlockian character, made some money. And the the Watson character is Welsh, and he marries a Jewish girl in this time. So they're really wonderful books and take you all around Victorian London. So if Julia, you're partly responsible for the research, you've done a really great job, because I think the one he wrote about Tsar Nicholas II, before he was married, before he became, while he was the Crown Prince of Russia. Honestly, that was a brilliant book. And I've never even thought about some of the issues that he raised in it. You'd love it.
It's called Dance with Death.
Sorry?
I said it's called Dance with Death, and they're beautiful books. Yeah. I've typed them and edited them for years, and Will calls me Barker's conscience because I'll always say Barker wouldn't do that or something. I weigh in and give him my 2 cents every now and then. So they're just.
I feel like nothing throws you out of a story more than when you see a character do something that you know they wouldn't do.
Right.
Really good point. Well, thank you, ladies. It's been a real pleasure to talk to both of you. I'm glad the digressions don't throw you.
thank you so much. I appreciate it, Lauren. And Barbara, I appreciate you both. Fun.
Well, it's always fun. Give Will my best. And
I will.
You and your family, Lauren, have a wonderful time in upstate or near upstate New York. And we'll talk to you before too long. Bye, everybody.
Thanks so much. Bye, everybody.
And we do have copies here of the, I forgot the pitch, the Radcliffe Ladies Reading Club and Lauren's book, Cool Wars and Wedding, which is amazing. And we still do have a few copies left. So. Night, everybody.
Good night.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.